I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. A year ago, the U.S. was ending its longest war with a chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan. Kabul fell quickly as the Taliban took control and thousands of Afghans fled to the airport hoping to be airlifted out of the country. A suicide bombing near the airport killed more than 170 people, including 13 American service members. Coming up, we'll hear about a Marine's years-long effort to get his Afghan interpreter to the United States. But first, what is life like for the Afghans living under the Taliban? While there is less violence, less war, there's more repression, especially for women and for girls, and more food insecurity. The World Food Program says more than 18 million Afghans face serious levels of hunger. We asked Christina Goldbaum to join us. She is Afghan correspondent for the New York Times. She's back in the States for a few weeks. And Christina Goldbaum, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
What is it like to cover Afghanistan with the Taliban in charge, especially for a female journalist, for you?
Well, things have definitely changed. You know, I arrived in Afghanistan last year, just a couple of weeks before the Taliban seized power. And what we've seen kind of slowly happening over the past year is what feels like Afghanistan being dragged back in time, back to, you know, the 90s during the Taliban's first rule. You know, I live in Kabul, and in Kabul, it almost feels like the lifeblood has just been drained from the city because there is this economic crisis that has, you know, gripped the entire country, and you're feeling it especially acutely in cities. And you're also just seeing, you know, everything kind of from the streets and traffic that is no longer, you know, back to back because there is such high petrol prices. You're seeing less women on the street. Women are wearing, you know, different clothing because the clothing that they were used to under 20 years of U.S. occupation is no longer allowed. You know, girls and have been barred from secondary schools. There is a deep sense of depression among many of the young women I talked to who grew up in a country where they saw much different lives for themselves, much different futures. You know, men who are going back to government offices have been told to grow beards and wear traditional clothes. Music has been officially banned, you know, in coffee shops and in restaurants and parks. Women and men are either separated into separate sections, or they've been told they can only go to those places on different days. And many women who were serving, you know, as lawyers, as judges, as police officers, they are no longer at their posts because they've been told to stay home. So it's definitely, the feeling in the country has definitely changed. And working there, especially as a journalist, has become, you know, much more difficult. Obviously much more difficult for local journalists, but there are certainly more restrictions on foreign journalists as well.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of the women, the girls, the men, the boys, having at least a taste of some freedom, of some ability to live a more free life, to have that taken away, and taken away so abruptly. How does the Taliban enforce these stricter rules and regulations?
So there's definitely this kind of undercurrent of fear that exists because of how the Taliban has gone about enforcing these very strict edicts. You know, earlier this year, we saw the Taliban essentially kind of close down Kabul to do door-to-door searches. So they were knocking on people's doors, rifling through their homes. They said looking for any weapons. But what that caused is just, you know, this kind of fear that at any moment, you could have, you know, Taliban intelligence or security forces knocking on your door. And also this idea that they could, you know, take you away, they could throw you in jail. That is something that has definitely, again, caused this kind of undercurrent of fear that we now see, especially in major cities where people are more resistant to their rule. You know, nowadays you have checkpoints where intelligence officers are checking people's phones. Journalists have been detained and beaten and jailed as they kind of tried to clamp down on the free flow of information. And these small women's protests that, you know, we've seen in Kabul, those have been very violently broken up. And it's sending a clear message, you know, that if you dissent, if you, you know, try to rebel against us, we will, you know, take that very seriously and we will absolutely clamp down. And again, that has caused a lot of fear among people who are resistant to Taliban rule.
Indeed. I mean, how large are Taliban forces? I don't even, or police presence? Are they omnipresent?
Well, it's definitely, you know, very visible. You know, again, there are checkpoints across the city, you know, up in the north where there has been some kind of armed uprising against the Taliban. They have flooded those areas with thousands of forces. They have helicopters that are left over from the Western-backed government's, you know, army that they've used to try to flush those rebels out of, you know, out of the mountains, out of these valleys. So it's definitely just very visible and very robust. And again, it's sending a very clear message, you know, that if you walk outside and you're a woman and you don't have your face covered, then, you know, a Taliban police officer who's at the checkpoint near your house might scream at you. You know, I've had, you know, members from the Ministry of Vice and Virtue that has been issuing these more and more oppressive edicts tell me to cover my face as I'm walking outside. So that kind of uncertainty also, you know, the presence of security forces and that uncertainty that exists, given some of the confusion around these edicts, has, you know, caused a lot of fear and I think kept people from, you know, going out on the streets and protesting as they, you know, might have, you know, under the previous government.
You talk about covering your face. Are we talking about burqas or you know, the kind of more traditional face covering?
You know, I've been told to kind of wear a face mask like you would for, you know, COVID. But again, it's, you know, you have to remember that, you know, Kabul just a year ago, you had, you know, young women and boys sitting in coffee shops, many covering their hair, many young girls didn't, you know, wearing Western clothes, right? So wearing jeans, maybe kind of loose-ish tops. And now all of that, you know, has changed. So women are wearing, you know, black abayas. They are covering their hair, making sure not a single strand is left out. You know, many, again, just because of the fear of what could happen if someone decides to enforce these edicts, are also covering their faces with, you know, with face masks. And in other areas, they are using the traditional kind of blue chadori as well.
Women have been forced home. It sounds from your description, both on the radio and also in your writing, that women are who had jobs or were perhaps even at university are now, what, forced home?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of women who are in, let's say, government posts, you know, working as civil servants, you know, women who were also lawyers or had, you know, other positions, top positions in, you know, companies, they have been forced to stay home, basically told, you know, from government offices, they were told to go home. They were recently told that they should send a male relative to, you know, fill their position in government posts. And that, you know, for a lot of families has been really difficult because on top of this economic crisis, you then also had families that were relying on two incomes, where now, let's say the husband was working as a day laborer, he can no longer find study work. And if a woman was working in an office and has been sent home, you know, she's no longer getting an income either. So that's been particularly difficult on families with women who are in the workplace. And then also, you know, again, for this generation of girls who grew up under Western occupation, you know, they had very different visions for what they could do in the future. You know, they wanted to work in government offices. They wanted to become lawyers and become doctors. And for many, especially those who are in secondary school, it's been this complete whiplash, you know, to a time that they had heard about from their moms, you know, who grew up in the 90s, but was very foreign to them. And so, you know, for example, like I've talked to a young girl, Farishcha, who is 18, who is meant to be finishing her last year of high school. And, you know, she had spent months after the Taliban seized power at home alone. You know, she wasn't able to visit her friends because her parents were worried about her safety. She wasn't able to go to school. She saw her future just kind of disappear in front of her and had fallen into a deep depression. You know, and now she, like many others, are just hoping to leave the country because they don't see a future for themselves in Afghanistan.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, whether they want to leave the country and whether they are able to leave the country. We know how difficult it was for Afghans, and we'll be talking about this, who worked with the U.S. military to get out of the country. What about for these more civilians?
You know, it has gotten harder and harder over the last year to try to leave. You know, I was in the southwest corner of Afghanistan where many people had been crossing over into Pakistan and Iran in November. And at that time, you had 5,000 people roughly each day trying to cross the border to get out. And since that time, those borders have been, you know, reinforced more security forces, both from the Taliban side and, you know, from, you know, Pakistan and in Iran. And nowadays, it's nearly impossible to get across those borders. You know, of course, people have found other ways, you know, trying to get into, you know, Pakistan, trying to get into Iran, but not as many people are leaving right now just because it's gotten nearly impossible. And evacuation efforts have really wound down. So sometimes people can get, you know, visas, let's say, into Pakistan to study, but it's become more more and more difficult now, which is why a lot of people have kind of lost hope. You know, they will still go to these embassies in Kabul that have begun to reopen, applying for visas. But they know that it's become more difficult, and they're turning to more and more dangerous ways to get out of the country. You know, smugglers who are testing new routes, and, you know, we're seeing that happening, you know, still, because the desperation to leave is still there.
You described the repression that's going on, but is Afghanistan now a country essentially at peace, or at least not at war, with the absence of U.S. military?
Yeah, so that's the other kind of big piece of what we're seeing going on. You know, I think for people, especially who are in the South, you know, these are people who have become incredibly used to American raids and airstrikes, you know, crossfire between, you know, the security forces from the previous Western-backed government and, you know, the Taliban insurgency, you know, roadside bombs. You know, for people who had become used to that over the last 20 years of just their daily lives, a lot of people who I've talked to, you know, in those areas would say, listen, you know, the economic crisis is difficult, but at least we have peace. You know, at least we're not worried about our family members, you know, being blown up in a roadside bomb. You know, there was one person I talked to, you know, Mohammed, who is from Kandahar in the south, and, you know, he had said, you know, the past two decades to him were defined by just not being able to escape the cycle of violence. You know, his 27-year-old grandson was killed, and he was, you know, just on a farm, and soldiers from the Western-backed government mistook him for a Taliban fighter and killed him. Uh-huh. He had a 17-year-old nephew who was killed by a roadside bomb. Mm. You know, his main source of income was a gas station that was once, you know, blown up. And for him, he's saying, you know, now I can go visit my family. I can travel on roads, which was nearly impossible before because there was so much fighting, because there were these roadside bombs. And so even though his income had been slashed by around 70% over the last year, wow, he said 70%. That was preferable, yeah, to having war again.
We're almost out of time here, but as we know, the international community has cut off money, cut off aid. There are reports of almost half the country facing some kind of, if not hunger, food insecurity. How do you imagine Afghanistan and the Afghan people coping with that, especially with winter just a couple months away?
So it's become more and more difficult. And I will say the economic crisis has become this kind of single facet of Taliban rule. You know, last year you saw foreign aid that accounted for like 45% of the country's GDP. Mm-hmm. It funded 75% of the government's budget. Pretty much all of that disappeared. And you had the economy contract around 30% in a couple of months. I mean, economists I was talking to was saying that it was one of the kind of biggest economic collapses in a short period of time that any country has experienced in history. And so moving forward, you know, last year, I think a lot of people were turning to, you know, relatives who maybe still had an income, returning to stores of food they still had from, you know, from the harvest season in the fall, and these kind of backup, you know, lifelines that, you know, were able to provide a bit of a buffer to the economic collapse. I think the thing that's concerning moving forward is that not only is there perhaps less willingness from Western donors in the wake of girls' schools still being closed, you know, the recent airstrike on al-Qaeda's leader in Kabul and the revelation that the Taliban had been sheltering him there, there's definitely less, I think, willingness or eagerness from Western donors to help kind of provide the foreign aid buffer. And then at the same time, you had people who really use up those lifelines. So folks who maybe went to relatives who still had some kind of, you know, stores of cash, like, they no longer have that. And so I think going into this winter, it's going to be particularly difficult. And folks who maybe weren't suffering last winter absolutely will moving forward. And so, you know, in that way, it is a pretty kind of bleak outlook for the country.
Indeed. Christina Gobam, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times. Thanks for your reporting on Afghanistan as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. That's Christina Goldbaum. She is Afghan correspondent for the New York Times. And coming up, we'll be talking about the relationship between a Marine and his interpreter. Be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. 2010 was a particularly dangerous time for the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan. Marine Corps Major Tom Schuman was fighting against the Taliban in Helmand Province and needed a skilled interpreter. He hired Zainullah Zaki, who did more than translate the language. He fought with the platoon and forged a close bond with Schuman. As conditions became more dangerous for Afghans who had helped Americans, Zaki feared for his life and wanted to get out of the country along with his growing family. Instead of welcoming Zaki to the States, he and Schuman fought American bureaucracy for 5 years to no avail. The problem was, quote, insufficient documentation. Last summer, as U.S. forces left Afghanistan and the Taliban took control, Zaki's plight became a more serious matter of life and death. Schuman and Zaki tell the story of their relationship and their efforts to extract Zaki from Afghanistan in their new book. It's called Always Faithful. And Tom Schuman joins us on Radio Times. He's currently operations officer at the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines. Tom Schuman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I'm sorry that Zaki could not be here with us. He has a job and he is working. But how is he and his family doing?
Yeah, Zach's doing what many immigrants that come to this country do, and he's working those hard jobs. He hangs drywall at a cancer hospital in San Antonio. He works six days a week, 12 hours a day. Wow. But you know, he's full of gratitude that they're safe, that they're able to start a new life here, that they've got a great community down there in San Antonio, and so he's assimilating the best he can, and he actually just had a son last week
while
we were
gosh.
In New York together.
So, oh, my yeah. gosh. So how big is his family now?
So he's got 5 children now, and yep.
How are they doing, the kids?
You know, he's got some cousins in San Antonio, so that's why he wanted to settle there. And so the kids have a lot of fun. They've got cousins their age. The kids go to the mosque, and they're able to play volleyball and cricket. And so I think the kids, I mean, you've got a family of, what, 7 in a one-bedroom apartment. But again, the fact that no one's actively persecuting them, I think that they're happy.
Well, and they're together, which is so important for families not to be separated.
Yeah, and that was this, you know, Zach's story is just of a dad trying to take care of his kids. Mm-hmm. a dad who wanted the best opportunity for his kids, a dad who wanted his kids to just be safe, and it's what we all want for our kids. And his desire to provide and protect for his family is what was really the just incredible courage and resilience that he demonstrated over the last couple of years is really remarkable.
Well, let's go back to 2010. You are fighting with your platoon in Helmand Province. And as I mentioned in the introduction, based on what I read in your book, this was a particularly dangerous time of the war and a particularly dangerous place during this war in Afghanistan. What was your mission there?
To provide security for the local population is generally, I think, what the strategic kind of mission was. What we were really doing is just fighting the enemy every day is what we were doing. But ultimately, to hopefully provide some security for the people.
And when you mean fighting every day, you mean fighting every day?
I mean like being shot at by machine guns from the enemy and us shooting them back with machine guns. Yes, that type of fighting.
And how did you meet Zaki? Or Zach, as you call him in the book, yes.
Sure. Interpreters kept quitting because where we were was so dangerous that it wasn't worth the pay. And at any given point, we were patrolling through these minefields, and the rate of casualties we were taking, the interpreters that were there just said, I'll find different work. And then the ones who were left there really didn't either speak English or didn't speak the local dialect of Pashto. So it was a tough first couple of weeks for me there with interpreters. And then Zach shows up. He's fit. He's healthy. His English is great. He's Pashto, so he speaks the local language. And he met me on a patrol, and we went out. And right off the bat, I said, you know, this guy is – it was transactional to an extent. Like, he's proficient, he's competent at his job, and he can translate for me. That was the initial part of the relationship. It's just I was happy to have someone who was solid at their job, but it grew and evolved into so much more.
And I do want to talk about, you write alternating chapters in this book, you and Zach, and he writes that on September 11th, 2001, he was 11 years old. So he had spent essentially two-thirds of his life, 20 years of his 30 years, living in a war zone.
And it wasn't necessarily super easy living before the U.S. invasion either, and I think that's why it was so imperative to have Zach's voice, and why I insisted that we write it together. Is just I spent 17 months in Afghanistan. I can tell you a little bit about the war. Zach was born and raised there, and and most of his life was the war. And so I thought, if we're going to learn anything about the country or this global war on terror that shaped generations, we should have someone who has, I think, some more rich insights into what it was actually like.
And I'm assuming, based on what you've both have written, that being an interpreter for U.S. forces, especially in this part of Afghanistan, was to put your life at risk for Zach.
I mean, it was to put your life at risk in multiple ways. It was to put your life in risk that every time you took a step, you might have your legs blown off. It was to put your life at risk that you could be shot at any time on one of these patrols. But it really, it made you a marked target for the Taliban. And as early as 2010, the Taliban already knew who Zach was. They knew what province he was from. And his persecution began while he was still working with us.
Why did he do it? I mean, he writes about why he did it, but from your perspective, why did he risk his life for this military mission led by a foreign country?
He was a patriot of Afghanistan, and he saw the best pathway forward for his country to have certain liberties, to have certain rights, that it was through a partnership with the U.S. to achieve what he had hoped, what he would want for his family. He understood how oppressive the Taliban was, as he was raised by them, and that's not the kind of life or Afghanistan that he wanted. And so he said, if this is where we can have some better governance, is this where we can have some schools for girls, if this is where we can make some progress, then I want to support this mission for a better, brighter Afghanistan.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Major Tom Schumann, who co-authored a book along with his interpreter Zainullah Zaki, and the book is called Always Faithful, subtitle A Story of the War in Afghanistan, the Fall of Kabul, and the Unshakable Bond Between a Marine and an Interpreter. And as always on Radio Times, you can join us. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Tom, help us understand then this relationship between an interpreter, or perhaps between you and Zach, and what his sort of what his job was, how you saw his job, how he saw his job.
Sure, his literal job is just to translate, and so I'm going and engaging with the local populace each day. We're going into these villages, and he helps me communicate with the local populace, and I'm also partnered with the Afghan army. So he helps me communicate with those partner Afghan army. But what he really does is he provides certain cultural nuances and understandings as we enter these villages that were blind spots to, you know, an American being in Afghanistan. And so he could help me read the human terrain and understand the environment from a cultural perspective that was extremely valuable. So don't go into this building, or this is how you should approach the situation. And so he's really, I'm consulting him as to how to do some of these interactions. But again, Zach ended up being so much more than just that. There were times, and I can tell these stories if you're interested, where he demonstrated extreme courage, went well above and beyond his duties. And that's when he really started to be so much more than just a translator or an interpreter. He started to really be one of us.
Well, in fact, I do want you to tell some of those stories. One of them is he's listening in on a radio, and he hears that there's Taliban in a village, and he sprints across an open field that, risking himself, I guess, for getting blown up by an IED, and tackles the guy. Can you expand on that?
Sure. Our interpreters monitored the Taliban radio net, and we, it's, I guess what's important to understand is the mine threat. We call them IEDs, improvised explosive devices, and where we were fighting and Sangin was an active minefield. And so how we patrolled through that is in single file line with an engineer, a marine engineer in front, using a metal detector. And so it's a very slow and cumbersome way to move, but everybody has to stay in the same path, because if you step outside the path, you're going to step on a mine.
Wow.
Well, Zach is listening, and he can hear that the Taliban is setting up an ambush in the village that we're heading into. And he says, you got to hurry up. They're going to set up the ambush. And you can't ask this 18-year-old kid up front, hey, go faster. Because those guys were routinely casualties. And so I said, Zach, we're going as fast as we can. He said, by the time you get there, they'll already have the ambush set up. And he takes off through what we knew was an active minefield, sprints through the minefield, runs into the village. He's able to correlate where the commander is coordinating the attack, tackles him, detains him, and then 5 minutes later we show up, and Zach's got a hold of this guy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and he was armed. Was that unusual for an interpreter to carry a weapon?
On this instance, he was not armed. On other instances, we did trust Zach with a weapon, which is definitely not the protocol. But often what would happen is we'd have casualties, and these guys are amputees. And so when you have a casualty that's an amputee, it takes three or four people along with the corpsman to put them back together the best you can while you wait for the helicopter. And so Zach would grab a rifle and hold security while the rest of us tried to patch one of our Marines up. And so, there were several instances where he did carry a weapon, and I wouldn't have trusted any other interpreter to do so but Zach.
Well, in fact, you describe, I think it was November 9th, 2010, you and your platoon in a terrible firefight, and you're, it almost sounds like sort of knocked unconscious. What happened, and what does Zach do?
Yeah, November 9th was a tough morning all around. It started off with one of my very good friends, Robert Kelly. He was killed, and then one of my squads was out on patrol, and they had a casualty, and they said, hey, we can't get back. We've got this casualty, and the Taliban keeps ambushing us. And so I went out with another squad and Zach to help alleviate the pressure of the squad who was trying to return to base with the casualty. And as we went out to them, my squad came under heavy fire, and we were moving around trying to get in a better position to repel the enemy attack. And as we were moving, one of my squad leaders stepped on a mine. It blew me up, and it blew my platoon sergeant up. And when I did regain consciousness, the first thing I saw was Zach there holding security, already trying to keep me safe, trying to protect me, and I mean, that was a really bad day in a lot of ways. My squad leader lost his leg. My platoon sergeant was blown up. It was a tough day, but to see Zach there standing over me, holding the security, ready to defend me, I mean, it just shows that he was really not just there as a linguist. He was there to fight and to protect as well.
Let me quote what you write in your book about that. You said that vision, Zach silhouetted against dust, still swirling from the explosion that flattened me, color and detail becoming clearer as my consciousness returned, as one I still see sometimes as I wake up. It says something about Zach as a man, as a battlefield interpreter, and as my friend. I mean, that was part of the bond of friendship that you developed with Zach.
Yeah, it's when it started to evolve into a brotherhood, family, not just a guy who worked for us as an interpreter, but a guy who was of us, of the platoon, of the unit. And, there's a fraternal brotherhood that happens within those units, and especially under fire, there's a bond that develops, and Zach just really became part of us.
At the end of your first tour, you're leaving, and you whisper to him, "Anything you need, brother, anything." And this was, what, 2011?
Yeah, we were on our way out in 2011.
Right. What did you think those words meant at that time?
I just knew that this guy had given everything and everything to this to these platoons. He saved lives. I mean, there are American Marines alive today, me included, because of Zach's efforts. And so I always make the same lifelong commitment to anybody I serve with, is like, whatever you need, it's not just while I'm your commander. It is an indefinite promise that I will always be there to support, help you at any time. And so that was just, it's an open invitation to however I can support you, I will find a way to support you.
And Zach writes, this is 2011, so Zach writes about what it was like, you know, after you left, you know, your platoon left, what it was like for him and the kind of threats that he faced, the kinds of letters he would get in the mail, the dangers that he felt for him and his family. Help us understand that.
The persecution was immediate. Like I said, it started like while he was still actively serving with us, they were already making those threats. And then he starts receiving night letters. You know, the Taliban would write night letters and leave them at his father's house. And they would say, if we find you, Zach, we're going to cut your head off. Mm. And this is not hyperbole. These are guys who cut people's heads off. And so and then they got his phone number and they started to call his phone. And then they poisoned him. And he had to get his pancreas removed from being poisoned. I mean, they were actively hunting him for over a decade, to the point that he couldn't leave his village and he can no longer work for fear of being murdered.
Well, I'll tell you what, another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking with Major Tom Schumann, and he has co-authored a book with his interpreter who he worked with in Afghanistan named Zainullah Zaki. The book is called Always Faithful, A Story of the War in Afghanistan, The Fall of Kabul, and the Unshakable Bond Between a Marine and an Interpreter. And after this short break, we'll be talking about the battle that Zach and Tom had with the U.S. government, with U.S. bureaucracy to get out of Afghanistan. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Marine Major Tom Schumann, and we're discussing his relationship with his Afghan interpreter, Zainullah Zaki, fighting the Taliban, and now fighting the American bureaucracy to get Zaki and his family out of the country. The book that they have co-authored is titled Always Faithful. And Tom Schumann is currently operations officer at the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines. And you can always join us. Questions or comments, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Tom, so Zach gets in contact with you. It's, what, 2016. He wants to get out of the country. How does he find you?
We were connected on Facebook. So, you know, we'd always been Facebook friends and exchanged some messages before that. But just that message in and of itself is an indicator of how horrible the situation had gotten for Zach, because again, he didn't join with the U.S. forces to come to the U.S. He joined and partnered with us because he saw that as a pathway for a freer Afghanistan. And so the situation had to be so dire for him to say, I'm going to leave my province, and I have to escape. But that's the reality we were facing in 2016, is that the persecution was so oppressive that he saw no other way but to come to America.
Well, now, this was back in 2006. Congress created the special special immigrant visa for Iraqis and Afghanistan. It's called a SIV or a SIV. What did someone have to do to qualify to meet the requirements?
12 months. 12 months of service with U.S. forces.
That was it?
12 months.
Allegedly?
Yes, allegedly. That's the way to put it. And in Zach's case, before he joined me with the Marines, he had served with an Army unit for about a year in a place called the Corrigal Valley, which was also extremely dangerous. Then he serves with the Marines for 9 months, and then he serves back in his home province of Kunar 2 years as an interpreter and contractor at an Army base in his own province. So, you know, we're looking at this visa application initially in 2016. Well, 12 months, you've got 4 years. It should be a no-brainer, and we start the application.
In fact, you write, for Zach to get an adjudicated SIV involved 14 stops. It sent the package back and forth between at least six different U.S. agencies spread between the United States and Afghanistan. Help us, I mean, that sentence alone, but help us understand the bureaucracy that made it so difficult to get him out of Afghanistan.
Sure. The long pole in the tent for us was always an HR letter to verify his 12 months of deployment or 12 months of service with the U.S. And so we had 9 months of verified service with his time with the Marines. And so really we're talking about a 3 month gap.
Wow.
And for a guy who risked his life, for a guy who saved Marines' lives, for a guy who's been persecuted for, at that point, 2016, so six years for his service to the U.S., we're the holdup initially is a three-month gap that we don't have the paperwork for. And the issue is that when Zach spent that time with the Army units in his province, they were Special Forces guys, they were CIA guys, and they're not guys who leave business cards or even maybe reveal their real identity. And so in 2014, they disappear overnight. They were in the base, and then he showed up to work the next day, and they were gone. And again, they didn't leave a business card with him. And so when he starts to try to get this paperwork, we don't have a point of contact to verify that additional 2 years of service.
And you tried to make the system work. Was it just sort of a logjam at every turn?
It was an immovable object, really, from the onset. And so from 2016 to 17, we sent dozens of emails to state and for this SIV program. And you only get an automated response with essentially no helpful information of how to reapproach or reattack kind of how you can move this application forward. And so after 1 year of very earnest attempts by both of us to advance this visa from 2016 to 17, we actually did not move it 1%. We were in the exact same place that we started on the first day as the last day in 2017. And Zach said, you know, I can't, if this is the reality, if this is not going to happen, I'm going to have to figure out a way to live here, because I can't keep trying to put my hopes into this thing that's clearly nothing is happening.
I mean, you're a U.S. Marine major. You're not a nobody. You served two tours in Afghanistan. Even you couldn't move this immovable object?
Yeah, well, I would say, you know, what I point to is 5 years later when we start to reengage with the program. Senator Durbin, I'm from Chicago. Senator Durbin was in a confirmation hearing with the Secretary of State and said, Major Schuman is on the front cover of Chicago Sun-Times today talking about his interpreter, Zach, and they're applying for their visa. This is now 2021.
Yeah.
How are you going to help him if we confirm you as secretary? What are you going to do for these Afghans like Zach and Major Schuman? And the Secretary of State goes, I know who he is. I know who Zach is. I've read that story. I'm going to make sure that we get Zach out. And so when you're saying, like, well, you're Major Schuman, it's like, well, now a senior senator and the Secretary of State are talking about our case. It's stuff like that that it was – we had advocacy at the highest levels of government. And we had advocacy from much more senior officers than me, generals, admirals, Senator Durbin, Senator Duckworth, bipartisan support, and nothing – moved the case forward. And the thing is, we were never asking for an exception. We were never asking for special treatment. We didn't say, hey, do us a favor. It was always Zach. The SIV requirements are black and white,
right.
And Zach clearly exceeded what the requirement was. And so we were just saying, let's honor a contract we made with these people. That's all we were trying to do, is not say we need special treatment. It was just, let's do what we said we were going to do. And even with advocacy, again, at the highest levels of government, nothing right. could move this process forward.
Including the Secretary of State.
That's what it appeared.
Yeah, well, I mean, not to give too much away, but it's, you know, last summer, when U.S. troops, U.S. forces, diplomatic corps left Afghanistan, and Zach is in dire straits. He needs to get out of the country. You have a conversation with him. What will happen if I can't get you out? His response was clear. Then I will be killed with my family.
When the president made the announcement in April of 21, I just reached out to Zach and I said, what are the implications for you? And as you noted, he said, my family and I will be killed. And and I said, okay, well, now this is going to be my full-time job. And if this means a death sentence to you and your family, if the U.S. withdrawal means that you will all be killed, I am going to. And so I started a little guerrilla social media campaign where I just put out a call to help. And I just said, hey, here's a guy who has met the requirements. He served faithfully with my unit and army units. Can anybody help me with his visa? And immediately a huge wave of support, huge. Everybody wanted to help, and they genuinely wanted to help. And so we start to get the media support. The New York Times puts us on the front cover. We're on Rachel Maddow, all this stuff, that this inertia, this momentum behind it, where you think, okay, now we're getting somewhere. And despite the immense and the overwhelming support, nothing actually ever moves Zach's case forward at all.
Well, let me quote what President Biden said on June 24th, 2021. You quote this in your book. Those who helped us are not going to be left behind. That's the President of the United States.
Obviously. Yeah, so I called a friend who had gone to basic officer training with, and he was a pilot. He had switched services. He was in the Air Force, and he was in Kabul. And I said, hey, Jared, is anybody going to go get the interpreters, or is anybody going to send them a message for them to come to Kabul to leave? And he said, Tom, if they're not here at the airport, they're not getting out. And so that was the beginning of a very harrowing journey where Zach had to flee Kunar to get to Kabul, and then there's, we could talk more about the actual escape if you'd like.
Sure. Well, he does go to the airport, as you just said, but then he's kind of turned back, and then it's too dangerous, and of course he's got his family, his wife and his children with him as well, and I think most of us should remember what it was like at the airport a year ago.
I would back it up to him leaving his home province of Kunar, and you know how the Afghan culture is. They all live in the same home. and so his brothers live there. They just add a compound. They add a another residence to the same building. And so, you know, him leaving his family, his hugging his mother goodbye, knowing that he's never going to see her. I think just that sets the stage for how tough this whole thing was. And then we get him to Kabul, and we're still operating under the assumption that we have until the end of the month. This is now August, and we think we've got until the end of the month. And so we're doing things procedurally. We're doing passports. We're doing applications. We're filling out paperwork because we think the system is still going to deliver. And then the Taliban on August 15th enters Kabul. And we say, okay, we've got to get out today. And so his first escape attempt, he walks 4 miles with 4 children and 4 bags and his wife to the airport. And the moment he arrives is the same time that that airport was overran. So everyone's familiar with the images of thousands of people flooding the tarmac and grabbing onto the airplanes. That's when Zach showed up the first time. And so to regain control of the airport, the U.S. partnered with the Taliban, and the Taliban just started to fire into the crowds to disperse them. And so on his first attempt there, Zach's children see someone machine gunned to death just feet from where they're standing. And I think of, if anybody's brought their kids to the airport, they know bringing your kids to the airport is tough. Now try bringing 4 kids to the airport, carrying everything you own on your back, walking to the airport, and then there being 100,000 people there all at the same time fighting for their life. And so that's our first attempt at the airport, and it's a failed attempt.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm looking at the clock here. Thankfully, he and his family do get out. And I'm thinking of those children witnessing what they witnessed and how just traumatic that must have been for them. And then obviously for Zach and his wife to try to, you know, to try to comfort them and take care of them under these extraordinary circumstances.
His wife, after the second failed attempt, he sends me a message, a video. He's trying to get in the gate again, and I'm telling him, I know a Marine there. You're going to link up with this Marine. And he sends me a video where his daughter's in his lap, and he's saying, they won't let me in. I've tried to meet the guy. You said no one's coming in. And while he's sending me this video, he's got his daughter in his lap, and then machine guns again start firing over their head, and his daughter's screaming, crying. And I've got a 3-year-old daughter. His daughter's 3 years old. And I just think, like, as a father, how horrible that situation must be, but how desperate must you be, how hopeless must you be to bring your child into that environment where that's the reality of how desperate these people were and how real the threat was that they were going to be killed. And his wife finally turns to him and says, why did you bring me to have my children trampled at an airport and us killed with machine guns? Why couldn't we just be killed in our home with a little bit more dignity? And the system never actually worked. Zach didn't get in the airport because of this. It was through personal heroism of a friend of mine who jumped the gate and pulls them in, and completely harrowing from start to finish how they get out of there.
And you mentioned the fact that they're doing better, but I'm also thinking, you know, there must be other interpreters, other Afghans who worked with Americans who are still in Afghanistan and wanting to get out.
Sure. I think the number is 87,000. 87,000 SIV applicants, SIV eligible Afghans were left. And many of them have already been executed, murdered, and many more will still face the same reality.
So what do we owe them?
We've got to be a country that keeps our promises. We're going to need our allies. We've always needed our allies. Look at historically, we've always relied on our allies, and we're going to need our allies again. And so if we're not a country that keeps our promises, we're going to find ourselves in a very tough situation in the future. And so we owe them what we promised, what was in the terms of the deal is, it's just a stain on our honor if we don't have the courage or the integrity, and we lose the moral high ground when we fail to keep these promises to these people.
Well, Tom Schuman, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Thank you for writing the book, too, with your interpreter, Zainula Zaki.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And that's Major Tom Schuman. And it, the book is titled Always Faithful, and it is co-authored with his Afghan interpreter, Zainula Zaki, who is in the United States, but obviously had to struggle against almost all odds to get out of the country. Email us at, replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times. Go to WHYY.org. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.